50 years ago this year, a new genre of music was created. Suddenly, there was this strange and raw sound. Angry-looking young people were screaming about their dissatisfaction as to the state of their lot in life. There were leather jackets, mohawks, safety pins, and a whole lot more. Punk had been born. But half a century on, what is its legacy? It's News Talk Daily. I'm Tara Duggan. Late last year, the likes of the Sex Pistols and The Damned announced that they would be touring again in the summer of 2026. These gigs would celebrate five decades of punk. 1976 was year zero for this new subgenre of rock music, and the likes of the Sex Pistols and The Clash were coming to prominence. But within 2 years, the Pistols had imploded, The Clash had started to dabble in ska and reggae, and post-punk had begun. The music may have been short-lived in some cases, but that wasn't the end of what had become a cultural and political movement, which continues to reverberate today. So what is punk? And maybe more pertinently, what is punk today? Joining me to discuss this is Professor of Punk, cultural sociologist, creative writer and experimental musician at the University of Limerick, Owen Devereaux. Owen, thank you for joining us on News Talk Daily.
No problem at all, Tara. Delighted to talk about punk rock.
Any excuse, says you. Take us back to 1976, or indeed pre-1976. What was the music scene up to that point?
Well, I think there's two elements to that. So the early to mid-1970s, you had glam rock, obviously, people like Bowie and Mark Bolan in the early 70s. But you had a lot of very indulgent prog rock, millionaire rock stars writing about their miserable lives in seven-star hotels.
Name names.
And punk.
Name names.
Well,
Owen.
You know, Johnny Lydon, I mean, famously, Johnny Rotten had famously his t-shirt, you know, I hate Pink Floyd. But if you go back, so punk explodes in 76, and it's this sort of seismic moment. It's a lightning rod for change in music. It had a prehistory. So in the 1960s, early 70s, particularly in the lower east side of Manhattan, you have the emergence of, you have the Stooges, Iggy Pop and the Stooges, you have the Ramones. You have a very noisy, garagey sound, which is becoming prominent in 73, 74. Malcolm McLaren, who goes on to manage the Sex Pistols, had an involvement with the New York Dolls in the 1970s, comes back to London, and assembles a band with John Lydon, Johnny Rotten, Sid Vicious, and so on. And, you know, it becomes then this, as I said, this lightning rod. I think you have to think about what was going on economically and politically, both in the UK, in Ireland, in the United States. You're talking about record levels of unemployment. Young people are disenchanted. And famously, punk rock talked about, you know, there was a magazine called Sniffing Glue, and the famous cover was, here's a chord, here's another, now go form a band. So you have a reaction to Thatcherism, to Reaganism. In Ireland, punk happens a little bit later, but bands like the Radiators from Space, the Boomtown Rats in 1977, they form in the mid-70s. Again, it's a revolt against the establishment, against the political system, against the kind of stuffy, staid nature of the world around. And, you know, punk had a message which was about, I think, particularly important about class, about saying to working class kids that you have the right to your voice, to express yourself. If you think about the fashion and the iconography around punk rock, you know, the black plastic liner bag, safety pins, all of that, you know, so very much in your face, very angry, very aggressive. Now, it does implode. And I suppose, you know, it was almost inevitable, like lots of revolutions, that they're relatively short-lived. But the influence, the legacy of punk, I would hold, is really, really long lasting. If you fast forward to now, I mean, there are lots of groups now that, you know, they hark back to what was happening in 76.
So you've set the scene for us there, Owen, politically, and where things were in the world, and this anarchistic sort of, you know, we need to tear down the establishment. But set the scene artistically, I suppose, for us. Where did this angry, loud sound come from?
Well, you know, the roots of it, as I've said, were in garage rock in the 1960s in the United States. The term punk would have been used there in that context. So you have that emergence in the early 70s in Lower New York, and then it explodes in London in 1976. And then that has reverberations literally all around the world.
And 1976, as you say, is considered year zero for punk. Why is that?
Well, you know, it, because of the formation of particular groups like the Sex Pistols, the Stranglers come to prominence, the Clash, and so on. And so it is, you know, it's that moment, you know, when these key bands start performing. And indeed, when these bands become banned, and the establishment, the BBC, music venues, it is impossible for a lot of punk groups to play. Even in Ireland in 1977-78, there's a lot of media coverage in the Sunday World. I was looking at this only in the last couple of days about, you know, a very strong negative reaction to what punk is all about. The Ramones played in Dublin, the Boomtown Rats were playing here, and even further on, 1980, the Boomtown Rats aren't allowed to play in Ireland. They write that famous song, Banana Republic. So, you know, it's a very interesting moment, and it's hugely, hugely influential.
And where did the sound come from? It's so distinctive. And as I said, you know, loud, angry. You see trends and fashions coming in and coming out of music in history. But was there something specific about why it was angry in that way?
Well, it was angry. Okay, so lyrically, it was angry against the establishment, but musically also, it was aggressive and angry. Some of that initially may have come from people's very basic ability or inability to play music. I mean, there were bands that formed where
I'm glad you said that, and you didn't wait for me to get to that point.
No. I mean, I think that's part of the aesthetic. I think that's part of it. I mean, now you know. Having said that, there's also the argument that you see that there are, even in those early bands, there are some really, really accomplished musicians who played in a particular way, but who are actually really phenomenal musicians. You know, famously in the Sex Pistols, Sid Vicious could not really play the bass guitar, whereas the other musicians were really adept at what they were doing. So it's that kind of combination of anger, you know, playing really fast, playing, you know, noisily, and then just in terms of the kind of literally the settings of amplifiers and the mix and the sound and so on. So it was very much about being aggressive, about being in your face and so on. And that's where that comes from.
You said that it splintered off really quite quickly and you know, sort of into subgenres and post-punk.
Sure.
Why was that such a short-run thing?
Well, I suppose there was only so much that could be done with that particular sound. But then, as you know, it develops on into what was initially called New Wave, where punk or punk style music becomes more commercialized and becomes more mainstream. So you can think about, you know, like all of the big record labels would have signed those angry young punk bands, you know, the Stranglers, the Clash, the Sex Pistols. They were all signed to major record labels. And then, you know, you have this mainstreaming of the culture. It becomes more popular. It becomes more mainstream in terms of record sales and appearances and gigs and so on. And you have this sort of literally this new wave of music, which has its roots in punk and reggae and so on, but is more commercially you know, it's more listenable to and pleasing on the ears, if you want to put it like that. I mean, Blondie would be a good example of a band that emerged in New York, and it would have been very punky at the beginning and then, you know, become more and more mainstream. But their roots are in that, you know, that context of Lower East Side Manhattan.
Some would say that that commercialization was a sellout, essentially, and that, you know, these angry young musicians who were trying to tear down the establishment became quite comfortable bedfellows when the money was becoming present.
Oh, and that's a fair point. And one of the big, it might sound odd to maybe some of your younger listeners now, but the big issue in the 1970s was whether or not you would agree to play on Top of the Pops. And, you know, then there were bands who refused to play on Top of the Pops, and then there were others who did. And this was often seen as a big sellout if you actually did commit to playing your song on Top of the Pops on BBC television. And I think you're right. I mean, I think that, you know, there is an interesting argument. In Ireland, there is a band, even now in 2026, called Paranoid Visions. And Paranoid Visions have been around for a huge length of time. And they're an example of a punk group that have never compromised. You know, they still look like punk rockers looked in 1976. They're a bit older, obviously. But, you know, they release their own music. It's still very much committed to the sort of DIY aesthetic, you know, a lot of punk bands self-released records and so on. So there are punk bands that didn't compromise, but, you know, the big names, they became more mainstream, they became more commercial, and that was the reality of that. But having said that, you know, the music then, like, so you had New Wave and then you had post-punk. So 1980, you had, you know, Joy Division ultimately morphing into New Order. You know, lots of, you know, the punk, the influence of it carries through some really interesting alternative indie music in the 1980s and indeed beyond. So if you move further on, then if you think about bands like Nirvana, even the title of their album, Nevermind, as in referencing presumably the title of the Sex Pistols album, you know, you have then more commercially sounding punk bands like Green Day in the United States, you know, and so the influence is and the influence is strong and is still in evidence.
How important, Owen, was the fashion, was the look? I mean, we talked about the mohawks, we talked about the safety pins and the leather, tartan trousers, rips everywhere. You know, how important was that to the movement?
It was hugely important. I mean, I remember myself, I was 14, 15 when punk began, and all you wanted to do was to customize the clothes that you wore, you know, and, you know, obviously, I remember piercing my ear with a safety pin. I remember, you know, getting one of my dad's donkey jackets and, you know, festooning it with badges. And I suppose, I know I write a lot about fandom. I write a lot about sort of fans as a subculture and so on. And there was that sense of the punks being the tribe, you know, being a tribe. And again, if you think about Dublin and London in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, you had identifiable tribes of punks around the Dandelion Market near the Stephen's Green Centre now. You had, you know, later on then you had goths, you had cure heads and so on. So being, you know, at that point in adolescence and early adulthood, being, you know, standing out, being part of a tribe, being part of that tribe is really, really important. So customizing things like, you know, wearing black, you know, bin liner bags, you know, bondage trousers, you know, the Doc Martin, you know, where would we boot out the Doc Martin boot? Again, something that kind of cuts across different subcultures. So that was really, really important. And that is then, you know, we see lots of that even now, you know, even in 2026, you know, we see, you know, particularly at a point in mid-adolescence, early adulthood, where people are identifying with particular styles of music. I had the pleasure last June of going to a punk all-day festival in Glasgow. So Sex Pistols, Stranglers, Buzzcocks, The Undertones, absolutely Derry's finest, 50 years on the road this year, went to see them play in Glasgow. And I was looking around me at, you know, all of the aging punk rockers like myself, you know, people in their 50s and 60s, and some people not compromising at all in terms of their hairstyle and you know, and what they were wearing, their T-shirts and so on. And then there are others. Sometimes I often kind of play spot the punk rocker, you know, where people have become more conservative. But you can see from the shoes they're wearing, or maybe the little button badge they have, or maybe the piercing or the tattoo that they have, they're still committed punks.
The telltale signs are still there.
And I would say this, that I think that in many respects, fashion is one thing, but punk is a state of mind. It's a perspective. It's a way of looking at the world. And it is certainly something that has stayed with me. It was revolutionary in my own life in terms of my thinking about the world and how I see it and, you know, what I went on to do in terms of my career.
That's an important point, I suppose, that those reverberations are still there for many who were into punk at the time. I'm just really curious to ask, though, Owen, what did your parents think when you stole your father's donkey jacket and covered it in pins and went down the road of piercing yourself with a safety pin?
I was very lucky and fortunate to have two very forward-looking, progressive parents who kind of enjoyed. I think they got great enjoyment out of that kind of self-expression. I was very fortunate to grow up in a house where music and books were important. We didn't have very much economically, very much in terms of money when we were growing up, but we had that. My parents were very forward-looking and they kind of enjoyed the fun of it all. I remember distinctly August 1977, the Boomtown Rats appeared on the Lake Late Show for the first time. My parents were going out to a dinner dance. People don't even talk about dinner dances.
My parents
anymore.
Used to go to dinner dances in the 70s and 80s as well.
Yeah. So, you know, and I remember, you know, the Boomtown Rats being on and Bob Geldof is there, you know, just talking about how awful Ireland is and how repressive it is and so on. And again, I think people often forget how, like, it's hard sometimes to imagine how aggressive, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but how aggressive the punk was and how it was standing up. I mean, Ireland and the UK and that sort of, these were very conservative places in the 1970s. So it was a big deal. And I'd say my parents really enjoyed all of that, and I think they saw fun in it.
And I mean, you're right, I suppose, in that time in Ireland and obviously in the UK, and I would hazard a guess in the US as well, younger people were supposed to be seen and not heard.
Yeah, but if you go a little bit further back, you know, after the war in the UK, you know, but not just in the UK, but really after the Second World War, the 1950s, 1960s, young people, youth become a kind of a problem, right? So if you go right back to the way in which people reacted to Bill Haley's Rock Around the Clock, if you look at Beatlemania in the 1960s, then if you look at sort of the hippie movement in the 1970s and then punk. So really, even over a longer period of time, young people, as they began to identify with music particularly and different gangs and tribes in relation to music, and they began to grow their hair long or cut their hair short or dye their hair, you know, for the last 50 or 60 years or more, you know, young people have been resisting, obviously, you know, what their parents and what the establishment are telling them. And they've been seen as a problem. And, you know, punk is a very good example of that. And, you know, people... again, it's worth remembering that, like, people, there were many, many conservative people like Mary Whitehouse in the UK who literally thought like this was the end of the world. The idea that the Sex Pistols were singing God Save the Queen, they were singing about anarchy in the UK, or that the Boomtown Rats were singing about unemployment and about dole queues in Ireland. And then even fast forward maybe two more years, the Virgin Prunes, Gavin Friday's band, the Virgin Prunes, side by side with U2 in Cedarwood Avenue in Northside Dublin, you know, the Virgin Prunes were cross-dressing. They were, you know, playing music in a really, really aggressive, you know, in-your-face kind of way. And people were really outraged by what was happening. And I suppose when you're young, when you're 14, 15, 16, you know, this is really appealing.
That's exactly, what you want. For your money, Owen, who for you was the archetypal punk band?
I'd almost go back before the Sex Pistols and think about the Stooges and the New York Dolls. But for me then, in terms of 1976, you know, it's really the Sex Pistols, you know. And if you think about the Sex Pistols, you know, there was the music, there was the look, but there was also then that bigger political statement, kind of, you know, like taking on the big issues. And the music, I mean, I was thinking about this lately. I saw the kind of reconstituted Sex Pistols with Frank Carter last year. I saw them at the Royal Albert Hall, which is kind of ironic in itself, to a full house. And what I was thinking about was, I was a bit anxious about going to see the band without their original lead singer. But what I took away from it was the songs, the sound, the lyrics, the message. That is really what was important to me and remains so.
And what about those modern day rehashed performances, these 50-year anniversary shows that we're hearing about this year? Yeah. You know, the festival you were at in Glasgow, for example.
Yeah.
You know, is that right? Should they not be kind of growing older gracefully, realizing that the times have changed and that, you know, life and the world has moved on?
Yeah, no is the short answer. The performance I've seen, and I would, you know, a certain amount of trepidation, and you were saying to yourself, you know, am I going to this purely for nostalgic reasons and so on? And honestly, my experience has been the music, the songs are so, so great. I saw the Undertones play in a tiny venue in Listowel last year called Mike the Pies, 100 people can fit in the venue. It's literally like a lounge of a bar in Listowel. And I went to see the Undertones last summer playing there. And I was just thinking how their music is pop punk perfection. Like, and the songs are just simply still so great. And equally with Stranglers, Buzzcocks, with the Sex Pistols, with their new singer. To me, the songs have stood the test of time, and that's what matters most.
What do you think when you see? I mean, I don't know if you saw this, but John Lydon was on The Masked Singer a couple of weeks ago. He was unmasked as one of the singers in The Masked Singer. Does that kind of irk you a bit? Is it a bit of a sellout?
No, I mean, there was earlier controversy about John Lydon doing the ad for butter in the UK, you know, and people were saying, you know, why is John Lydon appearing on a television advertising butter? And his answer to that was that, you know, he needed the money so his new band, or his current band, his long-term band, Public Image, PIL, Public Image Limited, would be able to make an album and tour and so on. And I think that's fair. And I also ultimately believe in artists being able to do whatever they want to do in terms of creativity, you know. So I've been talking a lot lately on various radio programs, including News Talk, about David Bowie. And one of the issues that comes up about David Bowie is there's a phase in Bowie's career where he's making music that isn't really popular. He was recording with a band called Tin Machine, and a lot of people didn't like the music. And ultimately, I would think that, you know, if an artist chooses to do that, then so be it. And, you know, I wouldn't take it that seriously. I don't perceive it as a sellout, you know, so it's okay. I mean, I thought you were going to ask me about, you know, John Lydon has been very vocal about the Sex Pistols reforming without him, you know, so that's been kind of amusing to watch from the side.
And what do you think if you see a punk now? I have a neighbour who's a punk, has a massive purple mohawk and goes round in the clothing of the punk era. When you see people like that, do you kind of smile inside and go, yeah, the influence is still there somewhere? Or do you kind of feel, listen, lad, you haven't a clue what this is about. You're inauthentic, punk.
No. I think two things. I think if there are people who are, you know, in age terms, if they are younger, you know, I think that's a positive thing. I mean, I think it's great that they're identifying with that as a movement, and, you know, and I like and enjoy, you know, people being individuals and being themselves and so on and you know, and relating to subcultures like that. So that's fine. And, you know, it's certainly if I see older, perhaps fatter, older punks, you know, I suppose really my reaction is fair play to you for staying committed to this, because, you know, it's one thing to be a goth or a punk or whatever, a cure head in your teens or in your early 20s when you're a university student. But remaining loyal to it is it takes some commitment.
Finally, Owen, the legacy of punk today.
Oh, the legacy is very much one of that the idea that people, particularly people who are sort of subterranean, people who are marginalized, working class people, other people who are left outside, that they have the right to express themselves and have a voice. And what I would say is that in 2026, you can see lots of really exciting and hear lots of really exciting music now that owes its roots to punk. And the most striking example, most interesting example in Ireland is a performer called Meryl Streak, particularly his song Death to the Landlord. So I would recommend your listeners to go and check out Meryl Streep as an example of, you know, he's a solo performer. And I just see 1976 written all over what he's doing in a really good way.
Oh, and Devereaux, far from a short-lived cultural phenomenon, it seems that punk is. Thanks so much for joining us. That's it from the podcast today. You can listen back to every episode of News Talk Daily on the Go Loud player. For now, though, from me, Tara Duggan, have a good one.